Okay. So last night we started talking about the four factors that together compose joyous effort, or the four factors that we need to really practice joyous effort well. Okay, so the first one was aspiration or interest. The second one, steadfastness, but I prefer the translation of self-confidence. The third one is joy. And the fourth one, our favorite, is rest. Oh, you didn't forget that one. We forgot the first three. We didn't forget the fourth. Okay. So when we were talking about aspiration, you know, that we cultivate it through understanding karma, and that we will experience the results of our own actions. So virtue leads to happy results, non-virtue leads to suffering results. And so when we understand that well, then we, of course, want to direct our mind in a virtuous way, okay? And when we were talking about virtue, was it virtue? Let me see here. No, it was the second one. Okay, second one of self-confidence, okay? So we were actually in the middle of discussing self-confidence when we had to end last night. We only got as far as verse 50. Yeah, but bodhisattvas need very strong self-confidence to fulfill all the bodhisattva deeds and to continue on the path. Because if we don't have self-confidence, then whenever we have the slightest little problem, we just kind of crumble. Yeah, you know how some of us are? Yeah, some of us, when there's a problem, we just get even more determined and we're going to conquer it. And then others of us, some little problem, and it's like, I give up, forget it. So if we have that kind of weak attitude trying to practice the bodhisattva path, then we're not going to get anywhere. Because, you know, anytime somebody doesn't appreciate us or criticizes us, or anytime we have a stomach ache, we're just going to, you know, curl up in a little ball and say, forget it all, I'm suffering. And, you know, then actually we do forget it all and we don't advance in the path. Okay, so we need that self-confidence. So last night we were also talking about in the verse, self-confidence should be applied to wholesome actions. So that's one area where we apply it. Second area, to overcoming disturbing conceptions and our ability to do that. By thinking, I alone shall do it. So this is the self-confidence of action. So we talked about that a bit yesterday, and how thinking I alone will, you know, I was telling you about my teacher who says, you know, I alone will go to the lowest hell realm to be a benefit to even one sentient being. Yeah, so having that kind of courage, that kind of determination, that kind of confidence, you know, to go ahead and at least try, okay? So it's an interesting thing, you know, when we look inside and see, you know, which areas of our life do we have self-confidence with, and which areas of our life are we just kind of weak-willed and easily give up? So chances are things where we know what we're doing, we feel more confident with. And things where we don't know what we're doing, the confidence is weak. But also where the confidence is weak, to have some confidence that maybe we can try and figure it out. Like maybe this isn't my talent, this isn't my strength, but I can try and figure it out and see what I can do. Instead of first thing going, oh, I don't know anything about this, forget it. Okay. Now, having said that, I know that there are many areas in life where I just give up. Okay, if I got a flat tire on the highway, you know, how do you change a flat tire? You wave somebody else down who knows how to do it. Okay? I don't have much confidence in changing flat tires. And I really marvel at the people who do. And I suppose sometime it wouldn't hurt me at all to learn how to change a flat tire. But, you know how we always say, yes, but, yeah. It's kind of hard, and I probably don't have the strength to do it, and I'll just make a mess. And it's so much easier to flag somebody else down, isn't it? Yeah. I'm happy to praise people who changed my flat tire. I'm not stingy with the praise. But I don't know if I really want to try that one. Okay? So it's these kinds of things in our life where sometimes, you know, we just give up before trying, and how we limit ourselves in many ways. Yeah? And I've noticed that, you know, there's some people, when there's something, we had one young man stay at the Abbey. Boy, anytime something was broken, he was in there fixing it. Even he didn't know what he was doing. Yeah, he would just jump in and play around with it and see how the pieces fit together. And he had a good time, and he would usually fix it. Yeah. But when somebody was unhappy and having emotional difficulty, he didn't want to be anywhere around. That was where he said, oh, I don't know, this is scary for me, bye. Whereas for me, you know, fixing something, it's not just flat tires, it's almost everything. I just give up before I start. But if somebody's having some kind of emotional difficulty, you know, their emotion doesn't frighten me, and I can sit and talk with them. Okay? So, you know, we can each see in our own lives there's certain areas where we are easily frightened and other areas where we aren't. Yeah? And so just to nudge ourselves a little bit to try and expand our abilities. Of course, I blame my inability to fix things on the eighth grade curriculum, the primary eight or middle school eight, what do you call it in Singapore? Huh? Secondary eight? Sec two. Okay, so you're usually about 13 years old, yeah? Okay, so I blame it on the sec two curriculum when I went to school. Because when I went to school, in sec two, the girls learned home ec and the boys learned shop. Now they don't do this, thank goodness. But because of this, I grew up very timid around any mechanical thing, anything that needs to be fixed. Yeah, because they never taught girls how to do that. They taught us how to be homemakers. Yeah, which I studied in Sec 2, but I never became a homemaker. Okay. When they need a cook at the Abbey, they don't ask me. yeah, and I've been known to wash dishes, and then people come in and say, look at the dishes I've washed, and say, why don't you get out of here and go do something useful, like give a Dharma talk? And we'll wash the dishes, because I don't wash dishes so well. I think I do an okay job, but other people don't like the way I wash. Okay, so, you know, to try and extend ourselves a little bit. And we really see, it's at the Abbey, it is so interesting, because we have so many different kind of people come and stay with us. And we have some young people come and stay, and we give them a broom and say, you know, sweep the kitchen floor. And they look at us like this, because they've never swept a floor. They don't know how to sweep a floor. Yeah, we have to teach them how to sweep a floor. They've been very pampered and spoiled by their parents, I think. Yeah. We have some people, not so much the girls, but the boys, and we say, make your bed. What's that? You know? I mean, it takes like all of 30 seconds to pull the sheets and the blanket up to the top of the bed. They have no idea how to make their bed. And they're like 20, 21, 24. Okay. So I see, you know, all these, just sometimes even simple skills like this, they're all things that we have to learn in the process of training in the Dharma. Yeah. If for no other reason, than to conquer our fear, yeah, and to conquer our prejudice, thinking that certain deeds we are too good to do, they are deeds for other people to do. Okay, so to conquer that and see that no, yeah, we should be able to take care of ourselves in life. Okay, so let's continue on. Again, still talking about self-confidence with verse 50. Okay, so Shantideva says, powerless, their minds disturbed, people in this world are unable to benefit themselves. Therefore, I shall do it for them, since unlike me, these beings are incapable. Oh, I like that one. I'm incapable of changing the flat tire, so some bodhisattva, please come help me. You know, it's all yours. Actually, I don't think this verse is entirely like that. Okay? But it's talking about many people in the world whose minds are disturbed, filled with wrong conceptions, discouragement, trauma, emotional imbalance, chi imbalance. Yeah? So people who have a hard time sometimes getting things done or being organized in their life or carrying through with activities that they begin. Okay? So Shantideva is saying, you know, these people, at least at this moment, are unable to benefit themselves. So therefore, you know, we develop the intention, I shall do it for me, for them. Yeah, since unlike me, these beings are incapable. So what this means is that when we meet somebody who needs some help, and we have the capability, and it's going to be beneficial for us to help, then rather than hang back and say, I don't want to get involved, we should step forward and benefit them. Okay. What this verse does not mean is that we should pamper children, that we should infantilize other people by doing things that aren't so difficult that we can easily teach them how to do. Okay, so when we can teach somebody, yeah, better to teach them than do it for them, because next time we may not be around, and that way they'll be able to do it. Some of us have the tendency to become Mr. or Ms. Fix-It. Okay. Not of broken things, but of other people's problems. You have a problem? Come to me. I will give you advice and fix your problem. Okay. Because some of us feel very uncomfortable when other people are ill at ease or upset. Yeah, so we want to go in and quick put a Band-Aid on the problem and make it all better because the situation makes us feel uncomfortable. Okay, that doing that is not necessarily beneficial to the other person. Yeah, stepping in and rescuing people when they need to learn how to be responsible for their own lives is not helpful to them. Okay? So helping people when the situation is such that you can see the person really needs help, yeah, and they don't know how to do something, or they're, you know, sick or whatever, reach out and help. Yeah. But don't baby people. Yeah. Don't feel like we have to go in and make everybody okay. Because that often turns into what they call enabling. Okay. So anybody here gone to AA? Yeah. They talk about enabling a lot in the self-help groups like Alcoholics Anonymous. And enabling is where somebody has a problem and you look like you're helping them and you feel like you're helping them, but in fact, you're covering up for them and making excuses for them and allowing them to continue with their bad behavior. Okay. So this kind of thing can be difficult to see because we think we're helping. Okay? So the classic example is you have a relative with a substance abuse problem. Somebody who's an alcoholic, or maybe they're abusing prescription drugs. Yeah. So they're drunk, they can't go to work the next day because they have a hangover. So you call the office, you call their workplace and say they're sick. Yeah. It looks like you're helping them. Yeah. Because it would be really uncomfortable for your relative to go into the office with a hangover. So you rescue them by making an excuse and basically telling a lie, saying they're sick, so that they can lie in bed that day and get over their hangover. So it looks like you're helping them, but actually what you're doing is enabling them to keep drinking because they have no motivation to stop having a hangover because they know that you'll step in and make excuses for them and save them from having to be responsible for their own behavior. So that kind of thing is not helpful. Yeah. So that's why I always say that to be compassionate needs a lot of courage. Yeah, because sometimes to be compassionate to somebody, we have to say no. And we have to watch them flail, and maybe they sink to the bottom in the process of it. But with the prisoners I work with, who I think I told you that 99.9% of them were intoxicated when they committed the crime that landed them in prison, they have told me repeatedly that they did not get over their substance abuse problem until they sank to the bottom. Yeah. And were stuck at the bottom. And then realized that they were the ones who had to change. That as long as a friend, a relative, somebody else would come in and rescue them, they would say, "Oh, yes, I'm very happy to go to the detox program." And they would sign up, and then they wouldn't go. Why should they go? They can continue using their substance. Their relative will always cover up for them. Yeah, so they told me it's only when, they were really like, "Okay, I'm at the bottom here and nobody's rescuing me, and the only way I'm going to get out of this mess is by changing myself," that was what made them change. So that's why I say sometimes, the most compassionate thing to say to somebody is no. Yeah. If you have a child who's always whining, "I want this, give me that, I want this, why so-and-so has it, how come their parents give it to them, but you don't give it to me, it's unfair, you're mean parents, I want parents like my friends, you're so mean." You know? So the last thing you want is for your child to criticize you, because then you feel really awful. So what do? Then you just give your child whatever they want. What's going to happen to that child when they have to function in society on their own? Will they know how to deal with the frustration of not getting what they want? No, they'll be completely lost. They'll go to work and they'll expect, their boss and their colleagues to do everything for them, especially if they whine and complain. Yeah. So spoiling your child like that is not a kindness, it's a disservice. Yeah. It's much more compassionate to say to your child, "No, you can't have that. Yeah, you already have enough things. This isn't something you need." Yeah, in society, we need to be careful of how much we consume because we're already using more than our own fair share of the world's resources. So make do with what you have. And then your kids cries and cries and throws a tantrum. And you, and it's difficult for you as a parent. It'd be so much easier, just give them what they want, let them be quiet. But that's not helpful to the child. Okay? So there's many situations where we really have to look and see what is it that is the most compassionate thing to do in a certain situation. So there's one story, I think somebody of you have heard me tell this before, but a young man told me that in his teenage years, he would very often get in trouble and get arrested by the police, not for big crimes, but shoplifting, you know, being intoxicated in public, being reckless, you know, being loud and noisy, this kind of thing. And he would often get picked up by the police, get taken to juvenile hall and juvenile court. His mom would come in, pay some money, take him home, and then he would do it again. He would just go out in the evening and do whatever, get in trouble. You know, he didn't mind going to juvenile court at all because mom would always come and, you know, pay some money and take him home. And one day in juvenile court, his mom said to the judge, "Judge, I can't handle him anymore. You keep him." And he had to stay in juvenile hall, which is juvenile detention. And he told me that that was the biggest shock in his life, because mom was not going to save him, and he had to experience the results of his own actions. And that's what made him figure out that he needed to change his behavior. So what looked like kindness on his mother's part, rescuing him for several years, was not actual kindness. The kindness was saying no and letting him go. "You mean I have to stay in the juvenile detention center? Not in my own bed? I have to eat their food? I have to wear, you know, they're going to cuff me, put handcuffs on when I leave?" But that was a big eye-opener for him, okay? So we need a lot of self-confidence sometimes to be very firm with people on things like that. It's not at all easy. Okay, verse 51. "Even if others are doing inferior tasks, why should I sit there doing nothing? I do not do those tasks because of self-importance. It would be best for me to have no such pride." Okay, so here, inferior tasks. Okay, so let's say somebody is doing the dishes, or somebody is doing the farming, or being the garbage collector, or whatever. And we just sit back and say, "That's fine, I'll let them do it. I don't need to do that. I'm too good to do the dishes. I'm too good to take out the garbage or be the garbage collector. I'll just sit and relax." Now the question. How many of you at family dinners help clean up and wash the dishes? How many people don't do it? How many people come from families where the girls are expected to clean up and the boys can sit and play or relax after dinner. Ah, only those few families? Really? Yeah. How many of the men feel like they're privileged by their family and aren't called upon to do certain things because they're men? Oh, none of you feel that way. I see. Okay, women, how many of you feel that the men in your family have special privileges that you don't? Okay. Okay, so that's what it's talking about here. Feeling like I'm a special person, I don't need to engage in certain kind of work. But Shantideva is saying, you know, even if others are doing these things, why should I just sit there and do nothing? What right do I have to sit there like I'm, you know, the king of the world and not help, not do anything? Yeah. If I do not do those tasks because of self-importance, yeah, or I do not do those tasks because of self-importance, it would be best for me to have no such pride. So if our reason for not helping or not engaging in those tasks is because of a feeling of self-importance, yeah, I don't have to do that. That's what the women in the family do. I can sit after dinner, drink my tea and watch television. And, you know, they'll just clean up because that's what they do. Okay? So that's an arrogant attitude, isn't it? Yeah? That's an attitude of self-importance. So Shantideva here is saying, you know, having that kind of self-important attitude or arrogant attitude and using that as the intention for not reaching out and helping or not reaching out and doing our fair share of the work. Yeah, if that applies to us, we would be better off not having that kind of arrogance. Yeah, because all sentient beings want happiness and all sentient beings want to be free of suffering. And other sentient beings are not our servants. Once my teacher, Lama Yeshe, he was maybe scolding us, I think. Sometimes he would scold the whole group. Yeah. And he would say, I remember so clearly, he said, your mantra should be, I am the servant of others, I am the servant of others, I am the servant of others. You know, so sometimes we pride ourselves, you know, oh, I've said how many million, oh, mani padme hum, mani padme hum, mani padme hum, mani padme hum. But when it comes to helping, do I feel self-important and arrogant and wait for other people to take care of me? Yeah. So he was saying, no, our mantra should be, I am the servant of others, I am the servant of others. What can I do to help? Mm-hmm. So for lots of us, depending on how we were raised, depending on the areas where we kind of slink away and let other people do it, yeah, it may take a bit of courage and a little bit of humility for us to step forward and do things that we haven't done before because we thought somehow we were too good for that. Okay. So actually, we need a lot of self-confidence to do those kinds of things, don't we? Because some of us feel, oh, if I do those menial tasks, then it means that I'm a dumb person. Yeah? No, it doesn't mean you're a dumb person. It means that there's a task, it needs to be done, and you're the one standing there. Yeah, it doesn't mean you're dumb. It doesn't mean you're better than anybody else and shouldn't do it. Okay, so to learn to conquer our pride. 52, when crows encounter a dying snake, they will act as though they were eagles. Likewise, if my self-confidence is weak, I shall be injured by the slightest downfall. Okay, so when crows, I don't think crows usually like snakes very much. Yeah, but when they encounter a dying snake that can't hurt them, then they act so brave. I'm like an eagle, because the eagles aren't afraid of the snakes. Okay, oh, I'm not afraid of this snake. I'll do whatever. But, you know, the crow's just putting on a big act. Okay, so similarly for us, if our self-confidence is weak, if we're like a crow, you know, then we'll only get involved when it's really easy things, like the crow with the dying snake acting very brave. We'll just do things when it's really easy. Okay. And as a result, we will be injured by the slightest downfall. So because we're only willing to do things that are easy, yeah, whenever the task involves a little bit of effort that we don't want to put forth, then we collapse. Oh, my little toe hurts so badly, I have to sit down, I can't do this. Okay. Verse 53. How can those who out of faint-heartedness have given up trying find liberation because of this deficiency? Yet even the greatest obstacle will find it hard to overcome one with a firm mind. Okay, so if we are people who are faint-hearted and we just kind of back out and crumble whenever there's the slightest difficulty, when we're trying to practice the path to liberation, and this is how we deal with problems in our practice, how are we ever going to get anywhere? Yeah, we won't get anywhere. So you're starting to practice the Dharma, and then you sit down to meditate, and your back hurts. Okay. Oh, my back hurts, I can't meditate. You're off that cushion like this. Yeah. Oh, and I can't meditate for the next week because my back hurts. And then after a week, oh, I better not sit down to meditate because if I do, my back may start hurting again. Okay? So those of us who, whenever there's the slightest little problem, we just fall apart, we're not going to get anywhere. Okay, and this is true for Dharma practice, and it's true in worldly life too. Okay, so I know some of you are doing Nune this weekend. Yeah, so it's a very wonderful practice with Chenrezig. You take the 8 Mahayana precepts 2 days in a row. The first day you have lunch and then beverages, and the second day you don't eat or drink or talk. And people go, I don't eat or drink or talk, I'm gonna die. Yeah? What kind of Dharma practice is this? Yeah. And I know the first time I did Nune, I was, you know, going, what's happening? Because in my family, you never went one day without eating. Yeah? Your mother never let you go without eating. I think in this culture too, it's the same. So one day where I'm not eating, oh my God, you know, like all my brain cells are gonna die and I'll faint and everything's gonna be awful. So you go in with so much fear that you set yourself up for having difficulties. Yeah. If you go in with a mind that says, this practice is about just dedicating myself to Chenrezig and dedicating myself to compassion. And so whatever happens, I'm just going to think about compassion. And I'm just going to think about Chenrezig and his beautiful eyes. And imagine having those eyes myself and looking at other sentient beings with those kind of compassionate eyes. Yeah. Then you go in and you do the practice with that kind of attitude. It's not problematic. It's not difficult. Okay. You also do a lot of prostrations during this practice. Like, oh, you know, no eat, no drink, no talk. And I have to do a lot of prostrations. You know, I'm going to black out. Yeah. They should have the ambulance waiting outside for me. Maybe I can cheat a little bit on the fasting day. Yeah. I'll just carry a little bit of something, you know, in my pocket. And when nobody's eating, nobody's looking, then I'll eat it. Even though I promised the Buddha at the beginning of the day that I wasn't going to eat anything. Really, you're going to do that? Okay? So we need to have some kind of courage, you know? And not frighten ourselves away. If I can do that practice, you can do that practice. Okay. So if we're faint-hearted and we give up before trying, we're not going to find liberation. But if we have a firm mind, if we're steadfast, if we're confident, if we're determined, then even there's a big obstacle, it won't, you know, deter us. We'll be able to face the obstacle and go ahead. So it all depends on our own attitude, on our own mind. If we have inner strength, we have confidence, then difficulties don't seem so hard. But if we don't have that, then even easy things make us discouraged. Okay, so we have to cultivate that kind of confidence and determination. Yeah, I'm not talking here about pushing ourselves. Yeah, pushing ourselves and being self-confident are very different. Yeah, self-confidence is like, yeah, I can at least try and do that. Yeah, and I'm willing to give it a try, and it'll be interesting. Pushing ourselves is, I really don't want to do this, but I should. So I will push myself to do this because all these people expect me to do it, and I should do it, but I don't want to. Okay, you see the difference between self-confidence and pushing ourselves? They're very, very different. Okay, pushing ourselves does not help us. Having self-confidence helps us. Okay, years ago in my practice, made a big mistake in comparing myself to my teacher. Because my teacher, doesn't need to sleep very much. Yeah. Always benefiting sentient beings. Yeah. I'm a morning person. Yeah, I like to get up early, do things in the morning, go to bed early. Yeah. My teacher likes to start things maybe 10 o'clock at night and go all night. Okay? And, you know, he does this, goes all night, goes all day, because of his great compassion. And I would say to myself, oh, I'm so lazy. If I only had more compassion, I would be able to stay awake longer. I would be able to do more for sentient beings. I am so lazy. I don't have great compassion. I should be like my teacher. I'm supposed to emulate my teacher. I ought to do this, but it's just too hard and I don't feel like it. Yeah? And I would try and encourage myself by talking to myself that way. Is that encouraging yourself? No. Yeah. You're not. There's no joy in that. There's no encouragement. There's just shoulds and ought tos and supposed tos and how come I'm so inferior. And talking to ourselves like that does not give us self-confidence and does not give us the courage to deal with difficult situations. Okay. But it's a tactic, this one of pushing ourselves. It's a tactic that many of us learned and many of us employ, but it doesn't work. One time, there was somebody who was in his Dharma practice, in his whole life, everything, pushing himself. You know, I should, I supposed to, I ought to. And I said, you know, please stop. That's not helping you in any way. And he said, if I don't do that, I'll be lazy. I need to talk to myself that way. And I said, give yourself a break. Yeah, you're not going to be lazy. If you need to rest, rest. If you need to slow down, slow down. Yeah? Figure out what you need to do to complete the task and do that with a happy mind. Yeah? And don't be afraid of being lazy. But it was really difficult for him. Okay? So remember yesterday I told you about our High Achievers Neurotica Society? So this is a quality of High Achiever Neurotics. Well, we push ourselves. And in the process, make ourselves and everybody around us crazy. Okay? So we have to learn to do things differently. Okay, next verse, 54. Therefore, with a steady mind, I shall overcome all falls. For if I am defeated by a fall, my wish to vanquish the three realms will become a joke. Okay, so every time I encounter an obstacle, I'm not going to give up. And every time I fail, I'm also not going to give up. Okay. Now, none of us like failing, and we often really beat up on ourselves very badly if we don't meet our own expectations. But I knew somebody who was on, he did admissions with graduate students at a university. And I said, how, when you're looking at these applications and interviewing the graduates, the graduate students, how do you decide who to accept? And he said, I look at how they deal with failure. I was like, wow, I had never thought of that. And he went on to explain, you know, because whenever you're doing something in life, in this case, these graduate students doing research, you're gonna fail. None of us can, you know, achieve everything we want. We're going to fail, but how we deal with the failure tells a lot about what will happen after the failure. Yeah. If we just give up and we slink away and we're embarrassed, then, you know, we never get anywhere. And he said, you know, the people who, when they fail, yeah, step back, look at the situation, analyze it and see, you know, what was the wrong step that they did or what was a good step that they forgot to do, you know. So somebody who could look back and really correctly analyze the situation without getting down on themselves and criticizing themselves and learn from their failure and then try again, he said, those are the people that I'll accept to the graduate program. I found that so interesting, yeah? And so it's made me now at the Abbey, I really look now at how people deal with failure because it says a lot about their character. And I try and look at how I deal with failure, too. Because I don't make big boo-boos very often, but I'm approaching perfection. You know, sometimes other people make me make mistakes. I wish it were that easy. No, I've made some very big mistakes. Okay. So the basic thing is when we fall down, stand up and keep going. Okay, so many of you may see I have a scar here. I think it's on this side. Yeah, I have a scar here. So this scar is I got it when I was like about 18 months old and I was learning how to walk. My parents don't smoke, but they had an ashtray on the coffee table. And when I was learning to walk, I fell down and I cut myself on the ashtray. And my mom told me that it looked like a pretty insignificant cut. So, you know, they didn't do anything special. But she was very surprised when it wound up as a scar, okay? And I usually forget I have this scar. Yeah, I'm not at all self-conscious about it. But it made me think, you know, when we're little, we all fell down when we were learning to walk, didn't we? Yeah, there's nobody who didn't fall down. And yet we all got up after we fell down. Because if we didn't get up after we would fell down, we would be crawling into this space tonight. And I didn't see anybody crawling. Okay? So all of us, despite our falls and our failures at learning to walk at the beginning, we eventually learn to walk. Okay? So it's this kind of attitude that builds self-confidence. We fell down, we get up, we try, we learn from our mistakes. Okay, let's see. So 55, I will conquer everything, and nothing at all shall conquer me. I, a child of the lion-like conqueror, the Buddha, should remain self-confident in this way. Okay, so this is the way that we should think of ourselves. Yeah, I'm just going to keep trying, and I'm going to keep going, and I'm not going to, you know, give up and feel sorry for myself. 56, whoever has self-importance is destroyed by it, is disturbed and has no self-confidence. For those with self-confidence do not succumb to the power of the enemy, whereas the former are under the sway of the enemy of self-importance. Okay, so this verse is talking about how to differentiate self-importance from self-confidence, because they're actually two very different things. Yeah. Self-confidence means that we have the ability to evaluate ourselves in a reasonable way. We know our good qualities, we know our weaknesses, yeah, and we're not afraid to admit our weaknesses, and we use our talents to benefit others, but without getting arrogant about it. Okay? So people who have self-confidence can also be humble because they don't feel threatened by other people, because they have inner self-confidence. They're not depending on other people to tell them they're good in order to have faith in themselves. Whereas people who don't have self-confidence, who depend on other people to praise them so that they feel good about themselves, yeah, then sometimes those people act in very self-important ways, because underneath it all, they feel very inadequate. And so to cover up feelings of inadequacy, they act like, you know, the king or queen of the world. But it's all a show of self-importance. It's not genuine self-confidence. Okay. So some years ago, I was at a conference where His Holiness the Dalai Lama was on the panel with a bunch of other people who were experts. I forget what the topic of the conference was, but a bunch of experts and His Holiness. And at one point, somebody in the audience asked a question, and all the panelists looked to His Holiness and said, "What do you think?" And His Holiness, in front of a huge audience, said, "I don't know." And it was dead quiet in the room, you know? Because people looked at His Holiness as the expert of the experts, and he said, "I don't know." You know, and in America, nobody says, "I don't know," when you're an expert. What do you do if you don't know? You shame the person who asked the question by making it sound like a stupid question. You change the subject. You make up an answer. You do anything but say, "I don't know." And His Holiness said, "I don't know." And then not only did he do that, he looked at all the other experts and he said, "What do you people think?" So he's respecting other people as having more knowledge than him. You know, do any of us have the courage to do that? Yeah, to say, "I don't know," in front of an audience when we don't know? Okay. But you see, this is the meaning of real self-confidence. Yeah. He could say, I don't know. People may be disappointed. People may criticize him. He doesn't lose his confidence because of it. He just feels good about telling the truth instead of making up something to impress other people. Okay, 57. Inflated by the disturbing conception of my self-importance, I shall be led by it to the lower realms. It destroys the joyous festival of being human, and I shall become a slave eating the food of others. So people who are arrogant, yeah, and full of self-importance, they create a lot of destructive karma, and as a result, they're born in an unfortunate realm. And even when they're born human, they are born in a situation where other people look down on them. Yeah, maybe in a lower socioeconomic group or something else. In other words, when we are arrogant and look down on other people, in a future life, we will be born as somebody who other people look down on. Mm-hmm. Also, when we're self-important, we prevent ourselves from learning. We're totally closed to learning. And so there's no way for us to improve because we think we know it all. So, who really suffers when we're arrogant and filled with self-importance? We're the ones who suffer, isn't it? Because we stop ourselves from learning. And we create so much negative karma looking down on other people. 58. Stupid. Ugly, feeble, and everywhere disrespected. Tough people, bloated by conceit, are also counted among the self-important. Tell me, what is more pathetic than this? Okay, so sometimes we will see people, yeah, who really don't have certain good qualities, put on a show as if they know everything and they are full of talent. Okay, they're bloated by conceit. Yeah, and these people are also counted as self-important people. But it's really rather pathetic because everybody who looks at them knows they don't have those talents and abilities that they're pretending to have. Okay? Can you think of people who are like that? Yeah? Everywhere they go, boasting, I can do this, I can do that, na 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 na. You see them in action, they really can't do much. Yeah, but they put on this show, and Shantideva says, that's really rather pathetic. Yeah? Why put on a show? Why not spend our talent learning? Okay, we'll just do a few more verses. Okay. No, actually, I think we'll stop here. Okay, so next year, same time, same place, different year. Okay? So we'll start with verse 59. Okay, so we have time for one or two questions? Yeah?
Venerable, I was just thinking, what's the difference between self-confidence and patience? Because it sounded like, is it more of self-confidence is before the activity and patience is during the activity or?
Okay, what are the two things you're asking?
Self-confidence and patience and fortitude.
Okay, the difference between self-confidence and fortitude. Yeah, they depend on each other. They work together. Yeah, because fortitude is emphasizing the aspect of having inner strength when we, in the confront of other people's anger, in the confront of insult and injury, in the confront of suffering, or when trying to learn the Dharma, and we face obstacles. So fortitude is emphasizing kind of an inner strength to deal with these kinds of difficulties instead of melting. Yeah. And self-confidence is very, I think it's quite related to fortitude in that way. Yeah, because if we don't have fortitude, we're not going to have much self-confidence. Yeah. If we have self-confidence, it can really, they help each other, don't they? Yeah, if we have self-confidence, then, you know, oh, I have a little bit more inner strength. I can endure this. Yeah? If we have some inner strength, some fortitude, then, okay, I can do this. And in the future, I can be more self-confident. Does that make some sense? Yeah? There doesn't seem to be a real nice, clear dividing line between them. But that's okay. Anything else? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for your teachings, Venerable Chodun. For the Dharma teachings, it's great to absorb it all, but if someone has dementia, is it possible to even approach this? And if someone has some grandiose ideas of, you know, self-arrogant behavior and has dementia, mm-hmm. and you're faced with this day in, day out, can you advise on?
Okay, so you're asking, as a family member dealing with somebody who has dementia and suffers from self-inflation because of the dementia. And so your question is how to cultivate fortitude in the case of this kind of situation. Yeah. Now, I'm not an expert on this, but what I've learned from my dad had dementia, not completely, and his dementia wasn't self-arrogance, but there were a lot of wrong views, not wrong philosophical views, but many wrong conceptions that he held strongly onto. And I think with dementia, it doesn't work very well to try and correct somebody and tell them that what they're thinking isn't so, because they just feel like they're not being understood and not being heard. So sometimes it works better just to join in the conversation. Yeah? Just join in. You know, like when we were kids, we would have all sorts of discussions that didn't make total sense with our friends because we would be playing with this or imagining that. Yeah? So sometimes that kind of attitude can work well with somebody with dementia too. It works much better than trying to tell them that what they're thinking isn't right. Okay? Yeah? One more question. Is it okay to be a servant of my rescued cats? We are servants of our cats at the Abbey. So I think you can be the servant of your cat. Are we the servant of our cats? Yes. Yeah. Okay, so let's dedicate. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.